Hello, my name is Dr. Christian Heim.
And my name is Dr. Caroline Heim.
We've got some exciting news.
We'll be talking about all things relationship.
All things relationship.
All things relationship.
That's a lot to talk about, Caroline.
Well, we've got a lot of talk shows to talk about it.
We have a lot of talk shows to talk about it, but what we are going to do is we're going to look at a study that has been done on relationships so that everything is backed by the science that we talk about here, and then we'll be looking at how you can apply some of that science into your life and into your relationship, and we will be looking at those relationship issues that perhaps we all come across and need a little bit of help in from time to time, Caroline.
Yeah, so it's really for people that are perhaps struggling in their relationship or want to make their relationship better, whether you're just starting out in a relationship, you're 20 years in, you're 50 years in. It's actually for anyone that's in a relationship, in a long-term relationship or wants to be in a long-term relationship.
And it's not only for people who are struggling, not only for people who are looking at a relationship, but if you're in a good relationship, hey, there's nothing wrong with making a good thing better.
Absolutely.
So we will see you, or you will hear us, on Friday night, 9 p.m.
Friday night, ET, so New York time, at 9 p.m.
Hello, I'm Dr. Christian Heim, clinical psychiatrist.
And I'm Dr. Caroline Heim, associate professor.
And together, we bring you research and tips on resilient relationships.
So welcome to episode 3. So what are we talking about today, Christian?
Today we're focusing on couple resilience, and we're talking about long-term couples, and specifically we're going to be talking about what threatens a long-term relationship.
Yes, so the threats, the things that threaten to tear relationships apart. And I do have to say that all this research that we're talking about today comes from our larger study, which we embedded in our book, Resilient Relationships, Techniques for Surviving Hyper-Individualism, Social Isolation, and a Mental Health Crisis.
So in every episode, we try to bring you some of the research and some of the science. We aim to take you inside the brain to see what's happening in a relationship or in resilience, and we look to apply it in your life by giving you some tips or techniques, and there'll be some stories along the way.
Most definitely today. Okay, so let's jump right into the research.
Okay, let's jump into the research. So I suppose we've got to talk about our paper and what we found were the actual threats to a long-term relationship.
Most definitely. So what we did is we interviewed 180 coupled individuals, and we've talked about this in another episode, but we asked them lots of questions, but we had to build up trust to get to the point where we could ask them the big question of what really threatened, were there any threats to their relationship?
Yeah, so it's easier to talk about what goes right in a relationship and how wonderful it feels to be in a relationship, but talking about things like threats, the things that threaten to tear you apart, that's a lot harder to talk about.
It really is, you know, and there were times when, you know, I thought, oh no, I can't ask that question. The couples are a little bit insecure. There's something, so we would talk a little bit more, but we always got to the question by the end.
Yeah, but tell us how you did that, Caroline, because these are uncomfortable things to talk about. Now, you said you took a lot of time and talked about easier things to talk about first.
Yeah.
But then,
yeah,
the
so
threats.
That's right. So, I mean, obviously we talked to them about the glue, which we talked about in a previous episode that kept them together. Then we talked about different things like division of chores or attitude to finances or fun and romance in their relationship. And we had a lot of laughs along the way until we hit them with the question. And the question that I actually ended up asking was there anything that threatened to tear your relationship apart, but obviously didn't because you're together? And I do need to qualify that there were, I will get this out at some point. I do need to qualify that the people that we interviewed were married 40 plus years.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So these are people who've been together for a long time and were doing what we considered well as far as longevity is concerned.
That's
right. If we could keep relationships together for 40 years or more, then I believe our society would be a much better place.
That's right.
Kind of the aim of what we're doing.
That's right. So the threats.
Okay, just to give a outline as to where we're going with this, I did want to ask you, so what were the top threats?
Okay, so not everyone had a threat. Okay, so two-thirds of the couple, actually, that's quite a big percentage, two-thirds of the couple said that there was something that threatened to tear their relationship apart.
Okay, and I'm just going to qualify that too, because not everybody wants to talk about the
threats. That's true.
As well. So I would actually say that most everybody would have had a threat of some sort, but people have different levels of what they consider an actual threat. And what can be a threat in one relationship that they can cope with can actually be the death knell of another relationship. Okay, so after we talk about the threats themselves, we might get into some of the coping mechanisms to see how people cope with some of these threats as well.
That sounds good. And they obviously gave us those as well.
Okay, good. Well, that's why I brought it up, Caroline. Okay. All right, so what were the threats?
Okay, so there were 9 threats altogether, but there were a top 5.
Top 5.
That were really significant in the percentages. So the number one threat to Tim relation, number one threat that...
Threatened.
Yep. Number one threat that threatened to tear relationships apart was the death or severe illness of a child.
Okay, so I'm actually going to qualify that a bit too, because we know from studies in the past that the number one threat to a relationship is actually infidelity.
That's right.
And I know that that's coming in at number two, but what we did in this study is we actually brought together death of a child and severe illness of a child and put them together because it was something that would affect people lifelong. Had we separated that, then infidelity would have come out as a number one threat. But I think it was fair enough that we did that to bring together just how much of an impact the well-being of children, and in this case, the non-well-being of children, affects a relationship.
That's exactly right. And I mean, that the whole thing is that divorce is 8 times more likely after child bereavement. So it is a huge threat.
Okay, so 8 times more likely after bereavement. You see, that actually speaks for it being the number one threat.
It does, absolutely, yeah. So we're going to go through all of the threats. We're going to talk about one at a time.
I think you ought to give the list.
The list of the top five.
Listen for, I was going to say their favourite threat, but that's kind.
Oh, Christian, really? That's so morbid. Really? Okay, all right. So death of severe illness of a child is number one.
Yeah.
Number two was, as Christian said, infidelity.
Yeah.
Number three was chronic mental illness in one spouse.
Okay, mental illness is a big issue for all of society today, for people who are married and non-married, single and coupled. It's just something that we would like everybody to be able to get on top on, which is top of. That's why we're doing some of this as well.
Absolutely. Number four was in-law issues.
In-law issues. Yes, yes. We don't know about those, do we?
No, we don't know anything about in-law issues. No.
But our couples did, so we'll bring you some of their stories, yes.
And number five was prolonged time apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So now, obviously, we're just talking about them fairly flippantly here, but these were absolutely huge issues for all of these couples, and some of them did consider divorcing during this time, but they stuck together through it. But it was really difficult for them to talk about. I mean, I had the privilege to hear the courage of these people and their stories that brought me to tears, brought them to tears many times. They held each other's hands, they'd touch each other, they'd hug each other. We'd have to wait for a wave of tears to go by and big sighs and all sorts of things until they were ready to go on quite often, because it was so painful, the retelling of some of these stories.
Yeah, but as painful as it is, the news is actually good news, because we are talking about couples who survived these threats.
That's right, yeah.
And unfortunately, life is full of suffering. Really sorry about that, but I think we all find that some way in all of our lives. However, these couples were able to survive these threats. And the significance of this is most of our study is on couples that don't survive the threats. And so we look at what people need to avoid. But wouldn't it be good to know how people actually survived it? And this is actually one of the first studies that looks at that. Okay,
just
to see these threats. And then we'll talk about, well, how did you do that?
That's right.
So,
yeah. So let's have a look at the threats one at a time, shall we?
Yeah. So let's start off with the first threat, death or severe illness of a child.
Okay. All right, let's do that. Okay, let me start off with a story then. Some were deaths and some were obviously severe mental illnesses.
Yeah. So when we're talking about children, we're talking about one of the primary reasons that couples are in relationship. Quite basic to our survival as humans in the species is procreation, is to have children. And one of the most joyous experiences in life is having children. And you want the best for your children. That's kind of innate in all of us. These threats became threats because that aim was thwarted in these people.
Absolutely. Okay. This is a story from Debbie and David, who have been married for 48 years.
Yep.
This is Debbie speaking. Our son was 18. He was an apprentice still living at home. One Wednesday night, he came home, showered, changed clothes, went to his mate's place, which he did quite often because he had an Xbox or a Game Boy. Four men broke into the house and shot him through the head. And it was absolutely terrible. Terrible. Home invasion. David was the rock and I was the mess. Then, after 12 years, David collapsed. He was on the brink of suicide, and that's when he started on antidepressants. You battle through it. Lots of support from friends. You keep battling.
Oh, wow.
I know.
I'm sorry, that's just so sobering.
It is. It really is, yeah.
I mean, okay, so we have children and we love our children, as everybody does. And to think at age 18, you just go out to spend a night with friends and you don't come home.
That's right.
And in Debbie and David's life, things were changed from that point on. And, okay, so Debbie says that she was a mess to begin with, and then 12 years later, David was a mess. So we are talking about an event that haunts you for the rest of your life.
Mm.
And yet, they're still together.
Mm.
And I suppose that's the hope, and that's the outcome that is protective for both of them, for the rest of their children, and for all of society.
That's right.
That they were hurt but not shattered.
Mm. Great deep hurt.
That's a really deep hurt.
I know. I mean, how do you survive? How do you even go on in life from that? I mean, one day he's there and the next day he's not.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not an accident either. And the anger and the... And they did talk a little bit about that. They joined a homicide support group and such, and obviously it was all looked into, and the police were involved. And, of course, then they had to relive it all, talking about it in all the reports, and so hard.
Yeah. Just before we go on to the second one, because we'll want to know how they survived that, okay? Any initial thoughts before we leave that? Because that's a big story to begin with.
It is a big story to begin with. They dealt with it on their own, each in their own way,
right.
This couple,
yes.
Okay, because they were quite different personalities, actually almost opposite personalities, and they needed their own time to grieve in their own way.
Yeah.
And that was really important that they left space for that.
Yeah. So I'm just going to say something about that because that's actually really important because right in that statement that you just made there, we see that dynamic on how a couple relationship is actually two individuals, but it's also one relationship.
Yeah.
So the outcome was that they were still a couple. So they still had what we call attachment, but they were also grieving in their own way. And respect in a relationship, if you like, is leaving time and space for a person to be themselves. So in the grieving process, it sounded like they were able to leave that time and space for each other to grieve through that. So we have that balance in relationships that actually do well. That you're attached as a couple, you are definitely together, but there's definitely that time and space as well to be your authentic self and to go through, in this case, a grieving process that you needed to go through.
Yeah.
Very all right.
Important.
Okay,
all right.
We'll get back to some coping mechanisms, but let's go on to threat number two.
Well, actually, I'd like to stay on threat number one if you
wouldn't mind, fine.
Because we did talk about death of a child, but we didn't talk about disability, which is a really important thing that came up time and time again, because quite a few of the couples had children with severe disabilities and how they coped.
Yep.
So this is actually Joe and Rob. Joe is Australian, but Rob's from Scotland, so a cross-generational marriage. They've been married for 47 years.
Cross-cultural.
Cross-cultural? Did I say? What did I say? Cross-generational. Oh, my goodness me. No, this is actually a cross-cultural marriage.
Yep.
Matty was about 7 months old when we realised something was very wrong. He had caught a germ at the hospital, and he's severely intellectually brain damaged. So that was a really hard knock for me at 24. And by the time I reached 30, I had a breakdown. I grieved and blamed myself for what happened to Matt, that I didn't do enough to save him. For 7 years, I didn't go out of the house. It's a lot of pressure on the marriage having a disabled child. If Rob hadn't been the husband that he was, we would have been a split family. We committed to doing this together, and we're going to do it to the last breath together, no matter what. Sorry.
No, that's all
I'm
right.
I'm just breaking down here because I will never forget that moment when they'd finished telling the story. And Rob looked around and he showed me all the pictures of their family around the room. And yep. He said, and I'd asked him, what kept you together? And he said, that we stuck together. And he showed me the pictures.
Yep.
Yeah. And he broke down too.
Highly emotional stuff.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Okay, so we're talking about severe disability in a child, and we can talk about some of the reasons why this is such a threat to the integrity of a relationship. Like in that story, there was the idea that maybe we didn't do enough to protect them, so people start to blame themselves. Or when it has to do with, let's say, an inherited disease, like Down syndrome, for example, All right? What starts happening is the pain becomes so hard that some people want to keep the pain away from them. And one way of doing this, and this is quite natural, this is not a judgment, is to blame the other person. Oh, it must have been your genes that did this. If it wasn't for you, or if we had done this, or maybe we should have made that choice. And that is one of the risk factors for people dissolving their relationship, their marriage, blaming the other person.
Mm.
Okay. Whereas if you're able to stay together, and as Rob told you just there, it was all these people, the people of his family, the close, the memories, everything that they had built up in relationship that kept them together. That's the ability to use your relationship as strength, emotional strength, to help you get through.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, 7 years not going out of the house when you're in your 20s.
Wow. Okay, so that also brings up the idea of sacrifice,
yeah,
and altruism. And in previous episodes, we talked about how important that is as an ingredient to a resilient relationship. In fact, it came in at number two.
It did. It was number two.
You have to be a person who is able to give, sacrifice, and put other needs before your own to have a good relationship. And yeah, when you've got two people doing that, the relationship is almost assured.
Mm.
However, let's leave the death of children and severe illness in children to go on to the number two threat, infidelity.
Okay, so starting with a story again.
Actually, before we get to the stories, let's just talk about some of the stats around infidelity.
Okay. Yep.
And some of the things that we found as well, because we actually know that infidelity is the number one thing that leads to divorce.
Mm.
Okay. So just on the statistics of that, if your relationship has experienced a divorce, there's a 50% chance that you'll break up. Now, that's actually good news, all right?
Because yeah, that's only half.
That's only half.
Only half.
That means that the way that you handle it can make the difference between the relationship staying together or not. Now, because it's the number one reason that people actually fall apart, everybody's afraid of infidelity.
Yes.
Okay? And obviously, do what you can to avoid infidelity, because it's a very, very difficult thing. And as a couple therapist, I've gone through this with people who have experienced it. It's very difficult to get through some of the ramifications of it. However, the good thing is that you can.
You can.
You can. Okay. And some more statistics. It's actually hard to find out how many couples actually experience divorce. the statistics will say somewhere between about 14 and 25% of couples will experience divorce.
Divorce from an affair.
Will experience an affair.
So okay. Can you just...
I'll clarify that. So of all couples, about 14 to 25% will have experienced a affair as part of their relationship. Now, those results are not very reliable because people don't actually want to talk about their affairs.
That's exactly right.
So all these studies rely on reports, as ours did. And in the 90 couples that we interviewed, how many did we find experienced an affair in their relationship?
Okay, so of the 90 couples, 8 told me about their affair and 2 implied it.
2 implied it, okay.
Yeah.
So we're looking at about 10%.
Yes.
Okay, so that's kind of in line, perhaps a little bit less.
Yes.
But if you account for people who were sitting right in front of you, that perhaps shows, you know what, we may just not talk about that.
That's right. But then you had this very courageous couple, Varun and Wayne from Australia, who
yes.
had been married just over 40 years, and they had just experienced the affair 4 months earlier. And they cried all the way through the interview,
yeah.
and they were dealing with things as they went. And I could not believe that they agreed in the first place to discuss it and disclose it, and then that they had the courage to talk about the details. And, I mean, obviously there was a bit of argy-bargy going back and forth in the interview.
Well, thank you, Varun and Wayne. Because of your information, the rest of us and couples out there have some information as to what it feels like and what can be done about it and what actually keeps couples together.
And that was why they wanted to do it. I said, why did you disclose this, you know, and are you okay? Because I always have to get their consent in the end.
Yes.
And they said, we want to help younger people.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's what we want to do, help younger people, younger couples.
That's right. Okay. A story. This is Laura and Philippe from France.
Okay.
This is Laura speaking. Philippe wanted to see the world, what it was, what the other women were. For him, it was just a play with other women. I had to say again and again that I was not happy about it, and it was getting worse at one point than he, and at that point he realized he'd gone too far. Maybe not too far, but just at the edge. So either he stayed with me or I go. We saw one or two therapists, actually. My friend said, oh my God, why are you staying with him? People are more selfish, so they think of themselves, but not of the family. His father was a good counterexample for him because he got married 4 times, but that didn't make him happy. In the end, he committed suicide. And then Philippe said after Laura shared this, we survived because Laura was so strong in her willingness to keep our marriage together. At the time you say, no, my marriage is the most important thing. At the time you say, no, my marriage is the most important thing. We've built something irreplaceable.
Irreplaceable. Now, we live in a society that would have told Laura to leave.
Well, that's the thing.
To not put up with it.
And that's what a lot of the people said. They listened to all, you know, they looked at social media and they're saying, leave him, leave him. Once a cheater, always a cheater. And this was such a big problem for them. It was such pressure to leave.
Okay, so that's actually a good thing to talk about right there. Once a cheater, always a cheater. And this is what it sounds like, because most of our information comes from couples who have actually divorced. But the implication of your story of Philippe and Laura is that after they sorted it out, once a cheater was once a cheater.
That's exactly right.
And that we can actually change and grow as people. Mm. And that one of the reasons I surmise that Philippe would have changed is because Laura fought for the relationship so hard, and he saw that the love that she had was enough to turn him away from something that was less important to him.
That's right. And they're now married happily 47 years and going strong.
That's great to hear.
Yeah.
That's great to hear.
Obviously, there were some other things in some other couples when they disclosed things. There were different things, ways that they coped. There was one couple that forgiveness was a really big, important part
yeah.
of what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting through an affair, if you can possibly avoid it, that's the best way to get through, to not have an affair in the first place. But forgiveness, understanding, acceptance on both sides becomes a thing. But perhaps the biggest thing is the idea that, no, we can start again. We can have some sort of a ceremony. We can put a line in the sand to say, that was before the affair. Now we are recommitting to ourselves, committing ourselves in a new way. And the relationship that we have here is actually deeper. So as a couples therapist, what I've seen is the couples that do well after something as devastating as an affair are the couples that say, you know what, we weren't really close then. We have now decided to make our relationship better.
And this is actually what one of the couples said. They went through a whole recommitment to each other.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they had a ceremony or anything, but they sat and talked it through and recommitted to each other. So going back to that commitment glue that we talked about last time.
Yeah, so I encourage people to actually, who have had this experience, to go for a better relationship. Because in a way, it's not good enough to go back to what it was, because what it was led into trouble, right? But from a bad situation, if there's something that can be learned from it to make the future better, then you take that and you make the future better and you say, no, we are stronger now. And there's some pride in that.
There is.
Good.
There is. That's right. And there was even a little bit of, pride in sharing their stories.
Yes.
To the point that, you know, when we went to publication of the book, I was a bit nervous publishing, well, we both were, some of the stories in the book about the infidelity. And we wrote to the couples.
Yeah.
We emailed them again, even though they'd already signed a consent form and said, I actually showed them the excerpt I was going to put in the book and said, are you comfortable with this?
Yeah.
Do you want me to use your own names or do you want me to change it to a pseudonym?
Yeah.
And interestingly, only one of the couples that had an affair asked for a pseudonym.
Okay. Okay, so that underscores something very important for us in our work. All of these couples shared their stories because they want to help people like you out there who are in younger relationships or are thinking about getting into a relationship, firstly, to know how hard it actually is, but secondly, that it's worth it and you can actually do it. And they wanted some good to come out of their experiences, because we are now talking about bad experiences. That's what threats are. They're bad experiences. But if you can get through it, there's something in the human spirit that can grow and develop to become something more and something better and to work towards growth and goodness in all of us.
Fantastic.
All right. Shall we leave the vexed question of infidelity and move on to threat number three?
Which was mental illness in one spouse.
Mental illness, okay, in one spouse. Yeah, so as a psychiatrist, I do look at all the mental illness that is in our society at the moment, and I weep because it is not in our genes, it is in the way that we are living, and part of the work that we're doing here is to show that having resilient relationships, in this case couple relationships, but all relationships, is what would really improve our mental health. It's not the only thing, but it's one of the primary things. So do we have a story about mental health in a relationship?
We do. Okay, so this is a story from Jim and Pat, who are from the United States, and they've been married for 54 years. Jim starts off, and then Pat follows. I have serious PTSD from Vietnam. How she put up with me after I came back from Vietnam, I don't know. And Pat says, and nor do I. Jim goes on. A lot of guys went to drugs, alcohol, or something. I went to work 50, 60, 70 hours a week. I found it very difficult to maintain close relationships because I learned in combat that you don't do that. People die. You lose them. It was really tough for me to get close to my family. And then Pat finished off by saying, in our household, the Vietnam War has never ended. And that's been very hard for me. And then she started crying.
Yeah. Mental illness is really, really difficult, particularly PTSD. And I've done a lot of work in combat-related PTSD. And some guys from Vietnam, a lot more from Afghanistan as the years went by. But for each of the guys in particular, and there are, of course, women with PTSD as well, from combat relation related issues. There's a long list of things that you've got to work on, okay? There are the nightmares, there's the fear, there's the anxiety response, there's the alcohol use, there's the anger issues, there are all the phobias, but there's also usually a relationship that's on the brink of extinction. And so, in a way, this is one of the things that brought me to couples therapy, because I had to work on the relationship, because if we lost that, then everything else would be much harder to work on. And because other therapists said to me, look, I'll be happy to see them for their relationship if you cure their PTSD. Mm. Well, I realized that their relationship would be over by the time they would be, by the time the PTSD was taken care of. So I brought spouses in and we started doing couples therapy, even though somebody was still unwell with PTSD. And there was hope. There were some good results, but it's difficult. Mental illness is difficult.
And it goes on. And this is what some of the couples, obviously, there was one couple that the woman had clinical depression, and she'd had, I think she said, 300 ECTs.
And, 300 ECTs.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. She, her husband, this is an Australian couple that had been together for a long time, he just stayed by her side the whole time. She would go to very, very dark places. And she kept on saying in the interview, I don't know why he stayed with me. I don't know why you're still here. I don't know why. I don't know why.
Did he say why?
Because he loved her. And he saw it as an illness, just as an illness, like yep. if she had diabetes or, yep. or something like that. And he stayed together because, and they told me the story of when they met, and they had such great love. And it was sacrifice. It was because they, you know, there was one point where she really nearly lost her life.
Yep.
A psychiatrist was working very close with them. Again, that yep. really helped yep. and helped their relationship tremendously.
Yeah.
But he just believed that he was in it for the long haul. And the way he looked at her after those many, many years, there was so much love in
it. Okay. So we're emphasizing love here.
Yes.
And love is one of those things that we still don't quite understand. It's got many facets. There are many types of love. But here, when we're talking about an eros love, a love between a man and a woman, you saw that.
Mm.
You said that you saw that in the interview. What did you actually see?
I just saw a sparkle in their eyes.
A sparkle in
yeah.
their eyes.
And
yeah.
just a knowing.
Yeah.
Like, I know you.
Yeah.
And I love you.
Yeah.
Despite everything that's gone on, despite yeah. what you're carrying, despite this illness, you know, we are together, and, yeah. and that is the most important thing.
Yeah. So the reason that I'm emphasizing this is because it emphasizes the oneness of a relationship. So I know this is going to sound a bit strange, but you wouldn't leave you if you had a mental illness.
It's true. Okay, bye.
That's right. You'd find a way to get through it.
Mm.
Or a physical illness,
yes.
or problem in-laws, which is what we're coming to. You don't leave the other person because of that, because you're wedded together, quite literally wedded together, which means that your problem is my problem. My problem is your problem. We've got to find some way through that.
Mm.
And I suppose that's what commitment is, the idea that we're not separate beings looking for our own happiness individually, but we are together beings looking for our togetherness and our together happiness together.
That's right. But there was, I'm going to throw a spanner in the works here, because there was one couple where both of them had a mental illness.
Okay.
So they had both had childhood sexual abuse and PTSD.
Okay.
So it was just extreme.
So that's the couple that said that they'd both been to hell and back.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Interestingly, and I don't want to take away from the work that they have done, but because the two of them had mental illness, there's kind of an equality in the relationship and more of an understanding in their relationship that I believe could have helped them, right? Whereas if one person has a mental illness and the other person's raring to go and develop their life, that's a very difficult situation. Okay. Yeah. I mean, every situation is unique. I don't want to say one's better than the other and something like that. But it's the dynamics that it creates, which means that you need different coping mechanisms for the different dynamics that an illness or any other adversity creates.
So my question for you as a psychiatrist is, I mean, you don't go into marriage going, okay, I'm going to tell this person that I've got a mental illness, or do some people do that? Or and obviously, in some of these couples, obviously it developed later or something happened, or it was only revealed to the person later and then they had the trauma that came out. But that beginning of the relationship, it's, you know, some things are covered up, aren't they?
Okay, so this is a nicely controversial area, but what you're saying is exactly right. So to get into a relationship, all of us, and I think you did this, and I think I did this too, you put your best foot forward.
Yes.
And you want to attract the other person, because if you want to go into a long-term relationship, you don't want them to leave. You don't want them to go off to somebody else. So you've got to make yourself an attractive proposition. However, before the commitment, there's a time of disclosure. There's a time of, look, I've got to let you know what you're really getting into here, right? Because that's just part of integrity, of being transparent enough to say, I'm not all that I look like, okay? Or you know about this, or I've got to tell you about that. Now, the thing is that particularly people who ended up in a relationship when they were younger, they don't even know some of the things that go in their own mind or what has happened to them that may be an impediment to a good relationship. So a lot is done on trust. Okay, so I'm going to take you inside the brain.
Yay! Always like going inside the brain, especially your brain.
Oh, my. It's very nice. It's very nice that you say that. Okay, so trust. I know it sounds a bit strange, but it's chemically mediated by the same brain chemical, oxytocin, that mediates love. That mediates feelings of love and attachment. So oxytocin is a brain chemical which we know is abundant in birthing suites, because once a child is born, a mother has this undying love for a child that it doesn't know yet, you know, that the mother doesn't know yet. That's love. It's an innate thing. It comes down, what did you call it?
What do you mean? Oh, it's the love drug that comes down when you're about to give birth, because, you know, you, otherwise, if you knew the pain you were going to go through, there is no way you would go through that.
Okay, so it's a love drug.
Yeah.
It's a hug drug. But aside from being present in birthing suites and present in two people who are in love, it's also there when, let's say, two business people clinch a deal and they shake hands and they say, you've got a deal, and they have to trust each other. But when you make a deal and there's a smile on both persons' faces, they look at each other and they go, yeah, I think I can trust you in this. Let's do a deal. And that good feeling of having put together a good deal is also mediated by oxytocin. So what does this have to do with the relationship? What it has to do with, when you fall in love, it's not just a physical thing. It's not just a sexual thing. It's even not just an emotional thing. It's also a mental thing and a brain thing that is mediated by this idea of oxytocin, which means it takes trust as well. Now, oxytocin in the brain does amazing things. It not only lets us feel love and trust, but it also chills the fear response in our bodies. So that, okay, so we've got a little place in the brain called the amygdala, whose job it is to keep you alive, but it'll keep you alive by alerting you of danger. If you see a snake or if you're frightened by spiders, it's your amygdala that's telling you, do something right now. Well, we now know that the oxytocin actually chills the amygdala to say, it's all right. Whatever happens, it's all right. And
chill out, amygdala.
Chill out, that's right. Chill out, amygdala.
We want your amygdala chill, especially in relationships.
Well, in relationships. And it works because even if you see a snake or a spider or you are facing something difficult in life that you can actually be fearful about, there's a part of you that actually goes, it's all right. Somebody loves me. So whatever happens here, I can chill. It's actually going to be okay no matter what happens. And that is something that a relationship does for you, a personal relationship or a close family relationship or a close friend, that helps you get through adverse circumstances in life.
So if something happens, they're there to catch you.
They're there to catch you. But the exciting thing, Caroline, is that this is physical. This actually happens in your brain. Okay, so another thing that oxytocin does.
You love oxytocin, don't you?
I do. And you're my main source of that drug, oxytocin.
That's good.
So the other thing that oxytocin does is it speaks to your hypothalamus and your pituitary gland to regulate the amount of cortisol and adrenaline that goes into your system. Now, I'll explain all of that because there's some big words there. But what the hypothalamus does is the hypothalamus is the center of moving your emotions into physical responses. So if your emotion is anger or fear, your hypothalamus tells the pituitary gland to say, okay, let's send a signal to give more adrenaline into the system so that our body responds to fear or it responds to anger. And the way the body responds is to bring up your blood pressure, bring up your heart rate, to all of a sudden dilate your pupils, to all of a sudden have you alert and ready for action. It diverts blood from your stomach to your hands and your feet so that you're ready to run or fight. This is the fight or flight syndrome that we have, if you need to. And that all happens automatically. And it happens because the hypothalamus says to the pituitary gland, we're feeling fear, do some fear stuff in the body.
Mm.
The oxytocin?
What does it do?
It talks to the hypothalamus.
And says, chill.
Chill, that's exactly right. So that means that when we feel love, when we're in a relationship, our brain can chill. And this is physical, and it leads to the resilience that we see in protecting us from physical illness and from mental illness.
And see, this is one of those things that you can't buy oxytocin on the internet. You actually have to get it from relationships.
Okay, so there are some drugs where you can get oxytocin, yes. You can actually spray it up your nose.
No.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yep. So, I mean, look, science works like this. If it finds something good, it'll bottle it, that's right.
And sell it.
Well, not only for selling it, but for doing good.
Okay.
And so for a lot of people's relationship, oxytocin actually helps.
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin nasal spray.
Oh, my goodness. Everyone's going to want to know and go out and buy it now, Christian.
But the best way to get oxytocin is to have good relationships.
There we go. Okay, back to relationships. We're on track
back to relationships.
Let's
go to threat number four.
Okay, which is in-law issues.
In-law issues.
In-law issues. So let me tell you a little bit about in-law issues in the couples. There's lots of pressure from in-laws with certain couples. I'll tell you two different stories because they're, you know, different pressures that came for each of these couples. So Olga and Raul are from Paraguay. They've been married for 45 years. And this is Olga speaking. Raul's whole entire family didn't want us to get married. 150 people were invited to the wedding. Only 20 showed up. Some are still waiting for us to get divorced. So they
keep
had
waiting.
That's right, exactly. Keep waiting because they really have been through an incredible amount. This poor couple, so much pressure from both sides of the family. So it's not just one set of in-laws, but the other side too.
Yeah.
So that's Olga and Raul, and then Gary and Ruth. So Gary is actually American, and Ruth is Australian, and they plan to live overseas early when they got married. And this is Gary speaking. Ruth's dad was saying things like, I'm going to lay down on the runway in front of the plane. Okay. I'm not going to let you go.
Okay.
So there was, these are quite extreme responses, not turning up at a wedding, threatening to, lie in front of her down on a runway. Pretty extreme responses.
They're pretty extreme responses. And it shows how strong the bond is to families. And as children, we are all bound to families, and it's one of the strongest bonds in human existence. And if you like, we call it storge love. It's the belonging love. It's where you share DNA. It's when you feel together with a family, and it gets very strong. However, you have to leave that to change your life priority to be in relationship with somebody else. And that transition can be very difficult and can take a few years, or it can take 40 years for some people to finally live their family relationships.
To leave their family.
To leave their family relationship.
It can.
Or at least put it as a lower priority.
Yeah, it's a matter of priority. Family is always there. But it's this hierarchy thing, you know.
Yes, it is.
Because what, you want to go on holidays and you know, your sister-in-laws come with you just in your mind, or the pressure of the family, the outside family is always there, and there's these expectations, there's judgment, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of your family. And this happens in couples. Your family are
often
like this. My family are like this, you know. Yours do this. Well, I wasn't brought up with that. Well, I do it this way and I do it that way from family of origin.
And ideally, a family of origin want what's best for you. However, as you grow up and you stay there for 18, 20 years, 25 years, whatever, they feel that they know you better than anybody else. They then have expectations as to what is good for you. And if your choice may be for something different, they actually feel offended. They actually feel that you're making a mistake and they want to save you from this mistake. And look, there are some people that make mistakes, right? But in-law pressures come from not accepting the love partner choice of your child. So basically what I'm saying is, if your children or your sibling chooses somebody that you don't like or that you don't understand, take some time to talk about it. Find what you can to accept that person and understand that person. Because if you force somebody into a situation that they have to choose between their love partner and their family of origin, the idea is that they actually choose their love partner.
Very important.
Yeah, it's very important choice. Yeah.
Very important choice. Yeah. I've turned to you.
Yeah.
Even though they may be yelling in the background, I've turned to you. It's actually quite a really beautiful thing when when it's a complete turning to the other partner, not, oh, listening, I've got one ear out to listen to what they
That's
say
right.
and they're whispering in my ear.
That's
and
right.
and out it comes.
That's
know?
Right. So when we're talking about Olga and Raul, for example, I didn't interview them, but just the story gives me the sense of, well, okay, if these in-laws don't want us married, we'll show them.
That's exactly right. And that was their big coping mechanism.
Okay.
Teamwork.
Teamwork. Okay.
We're going to be a team.
Yes.
It's us against the world. It's
yes.
team, team, team. That yeah. was the way they approached it.
Yeah. So if people don't accept the love partner of their child or sibling, you're going to lose.
Mm.
Particularly if these people use teamwork to become a good, resilient relationship.
And there's always going to be something you don't like about a daughter-in-law or a son. There's always, always going to be something. And it's often a values clash too.
Values clash, yeah. So when we're talking about coping mechanisms, how do you cope with in-laws that are putting pressure on you?
Well, we've already talked about turning to the other partner and not listening to the things being whispered in your ear.
Yeah, so I'll articulate that as a technique. And the technique is putting up boundaries. So a boundary is a fence or a line that is not to be crossed. Whenever you hug your love partner, you're actually putting a boundary around them to say, we belong together. I am keeping the rest of the world out of this particular moment when I'm hugging you, right? So there are arms around somebody's back. And it's not so much saying you belong to me. It's saying I'm protecting you from the rest of the world.
Mm.
There is a boundary there. So you talked about looking inwards to your partner. And that becomes your world. And if you make that a very large world and a very exciting and interesting world, which it actually is getting to know somebody else, then it actually becomes protective of outside adversity.
And also it's forging your own values, your own couple values together, saying, okay, they were those values, and yes, you're different than that, but where are our values? Where do we come together? And we talked about values in the last episode. And I think that's really powerful, because then you're forging your own family values. And as you said, as you were implying, one of our catchphrases for our resilient relationship work that we do is, it's you and me against the world.
Yes, yes. And forging your own values. And again, that came up as a top ingredient to keep a relationship together. But for all of your mental health, we talk a lot about values. And I have this little formula to be armed with your values, to look at what you admire in yourself and others, to see what you believe is the right thing to do, to see what motivates you, to see when you're filled with self-esteem. And the D in armed, A-R-M-E-D, is to see what would become really important to you if you knew that you would die in a year or so. Now, the thing is that that helps you find your individual values, but as a couple, it also pays to sort of sit down, well, these are my values and these are your values. How can we forge our values? Because when you get an identity based on your values, you walk together into the future together and more resilient.
Yes, absolutely. So even like with the E, how are we, when do we feel most fill with self-esteem?
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's a lovely, when do we feel really one and together, and that this is something that we're really proud of, that we've created in our marriage, you
yes.
know?
Yes.
And yeah, there's so much in all of that. And it's great. Like, you often talk about getting couples to sit down for a little bit of time each week to discuss these sort of things.
Yes. So shared values came in at number three, as far as the, top secrets to keeping a relationship together. And values is something that keeps you on track for life as an individual or as a couple, or even you have mission statements for companies now. So what that is basically your values as a company or an organization to drive you forward, so that you know what you're actually doing and staying on track for the right thing. So the message here is, for a resilient relationship, know your shared values. It will keep you away from the outside wolves like in-laws that try to whisper in your ear, because what you actually do when you leave a family, so I mean parents and siblings, you're actually changing your values. You're actually saying that there's something more important to me than what I grew up with. And that can be challenging for the other people. In true love, a family of origin will go, okay, we're really happy for you. That's great, because you are developing the self that you actually are.
That's right. And then their family actually extends, and
that's
it becomes
right.
one big family, which is quite lovely.
It is, because the nature of love is that love only wants to love and be loved in return, which means that there's love enough for everybody if we can do it the right way.
Mm.
But I think we can go on to number five.
Which is prolonged time living apart.
Yeah, prolonged time living apart.
Yes. Okay. So lots of different stories with this. So let me go to Mary and Brian. Okay. So Mary was alone a lot of the time because Brian was a traveling salesman. They've been married for 50 years. They're from New Zealand, actually. She said, I was alone all the time. He was gone almost all the time. I had a nervous breakdown. There are a lot of threats about leaving the relationship.
Yeah.
And then Candy was on the road a lot of the time. So we had the reverse here. And Greg was the commanding officer. So they were both like really super powered career people. And Candy said, we were just so busy. We were being pulled apart. So one of their coping mechanisms, interestingly, was that they found something to do together. One thing that takes time that they do every single week, setting apart time to do it together. So this was really great advice for people that are both really career seeking and trying to find a together place and time.
Yeah, so I'm going to go a little bit into the theory of attachment. So in other words, humans staying together, because we live in a society that that emphasizes our individuality, that says go for it yourself, that if there's a good job out there, you've got to take it. But what this ends up with is a lot of time apart for couples that are high functioning or just want jobs, quite frankly. And the science of the theory of attachment, which has been around for 80 years now, put together by John Bowlby in the 40s, tells us that we naturally attach to people who are close to us, which means that if you want to attach strongly in a couple relationship, you've got to be close. So the only quality time is actually quantity time. You've got to be together. So living apart for weeks, months at a time, or seeing each other only once a weekend means that you're not getting that proximity, that closeness to actually attach. And you will know that you're attached because you will actually feel lonely or incomplete when your partner is gone. This is not a sign of weakness. This is a sign of emotional and relational strength.
Oh, and this is something that society tells us, and this is a bugbear of ours because people are saying, oh, no, it's fine. You're all okay. And look, why do you want to be with them? Why do you want to spend all that time? You go away for a girls' night out, go for a girls' weekend, go for a boys' this, go for... And it's just... The messaging out there is, you know, you are your own individual, which we all are.
Yeah.
But that you know, you should choose that always above the relationship, because you've got to get what your needs, you've got to get your needs met. And, you know, that's a priority.
So, again, talking about balance, because there's nothing wrong with going out for a boys' night out. There's nothing wrong with going out for a girls' night out. But if you went out for a boys' night out every night, then... there's something wrong.
Yeah.
So it's basically you spend the bulk of your time together with your partner, and every now and again, you go out with some friends. That's that balance between being your authentic individual self and the balance between being a couple. However, to be a couple, it takes that time that you were talking about together and actually enjoying yourself together, to the point where some couples told us, well, why would you want to go out with somebody else in the first place, because you have so much fun with the person that you're with and you feel so good with them, that that's actually what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, a lot of the couples said that to me, but that's that generation too, whereas there is different sort of approaches to life in our 21st century.
Yeah. The generational differences.
Yeah, that, well, then that's a big thing, you know, because they're not going to understand that, that need. But at the same time, people in this generation may not understand that you know, they want to be together all the time.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So let me just sum up some of the things that we've been saying here. We've gone through the five big threats that we found in our study to long-term relationships, and they were... Okay, so the first one was the death or the illness of a child. The second one was infidelity. The third one...
Severe mental illness
in a spouse. The fourth one was in-law issues. And the fifth one was significant time living apart.
Prolonged time, yeah. Well, that's the same thing, isn't it?
Okay, so with all of these things, there were coping mechanisms that worked for each of the individual people, right? But all of these coping mechanisms really come down to the relationship itself, because when you're together in a relationship, what it does is it releases oxytocin in your brain. And oxytocin is physical, it's a chemical, and it works on your brain to chill your brain so that you actually become more resilient, which means that if you become more resilient as a person, you're able to become more resilient as a couple, which means that you'll have more oxytocin released, where you become more resilient as an individual, more resilient as a couple, more oxytocin released, and you're in a positive spiral, and couple relationships can actually get better and better.
And I'd just like to finish off with one last quote from one of the couples,
yeah,
who actually sadly lost their son to cancer just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And after they'd gone through the grieving process, which they're still going through, obviously,
yeah,
they said the thing that we came out with the most was that the adversity made us stronger as a couple.
Yeah, so that actually is a lovely way to tie up everything that we're doing, because we're talking about negative things, adversity, threat. But you know what? That's actually the mechanism of resilience, okay? So if you look at a tree actually gets stronger by being blown in the wind. And we now have the science to show that trees will actually grow roots on one side if it's being blown in one situation, and the cells of the tree will actually change so that it becomes a bit more flexible, so it can cope with the adversity of strong wind. So all of these threats that happen to relationships is like the wind in the tree, making your relationship stronger. But it takes a bit of give and take, flexibility. It takes being grounded in something very strong, and being grounded in a relationship is that strength that you need.
I think we might just finish it there. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in another month for our Resilient Relationships talk show. So we hope you can join us then. If you want to find any of our other material, you can find us on drchristianheim.com. And we have a website there. We have material on YouTube and blogs and mental health podcasts, all sorts of things there. But Resilient Relationships is our main focus. It's what we are going to be talking about in all of our podcasts in resilient relationships in couples, in businesses, and in just normal friendship relationships also. Bye for now.
Bye for now.